there. Welcome to episode 65 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, thank you for joining me today on this sunny, lovely Thursday morning.
Thank you for joining me today, Brian.
I guess that's only fair. We are equal partners in this endeavor. So, yeah, I was being sarcastic. The weather here in Rhode Island is miserable. We're in the middle of a thunderstorm. But there is bad news in a lot of places right now, isn't there?
There is, but I will say that it's actually nice and sunny in Washington, D.C., at least for the time being. So, you know, we'll see if that changes. We'll see if I just jinx myself. But you're right. There is some bad news in other parts of the country, and both in baseball and otherwise. And this is a baseball podcast. I suppose we should talk about the baseball bad news. And
yeah, we should probably focus on that, because otherwise it could get very, very dark in this podcast very, very quickly.
Correct. So the baseball bad news actually contains a pair of third basemen. Zach Cozart is out for the season after discovering that he needs labrum surgery, and that's obviously a big blow to a team that already has a number of injury issues there with the Angels. And then Josh Donaldson suffered a setback, so he will not be returning in the immediate future for the Toronto Blue Jays. We usually talk about, you know, which one of these moves has a bigger impact, but I think here we should really just talk about them individually, starting with the Cozart injury. So you want to kick us off by talking about, you know, what this means for the Angels and what your thoughts are on Cozart heading forward now, because labrums are nothing to mess with, whether you're a pitcher or a hitter, right?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I really liked the Cozart signing for the Angels to kick off this kind of offseason that they've had. I really was interested in how they were going to use him as a third baseman. But like you said, the labrum surgery tends to be an issue, and he's a guy who I thought was going to end up moving back to shortstop at some point. Now with this in place, he may be a guy who's going to be a second baseman. I would imagine he's probably going to lose some arm strength. It remains to be seen what it's going to do to his hitting, which has turned a corner over the last couple of years. But this is a blow for the Angels, who have been just completely snakebit by injuries this year. I don't think it changes the calculation dramatically for the Angels, who are above 500, which is great, but the Mariners are pulling away in a hurry with the wild card spot in that division. The Mariners, the Yankees, they seem to be a ways ahead of everybody else, and I don't think the Angels were going to catch them, as we talked about a couple of episodes ago on this show. So I don't think it really moves much for the Angels, other than it may make them a little more likely to be a seller at the trade deadline. But I don't really see the Angels in sell mode either, because I think they will want to be competitive next year.
I agree with that. And it's kind of interesting, because you remember their offseason. I thought they had a very good offseason. You know, they went out there and made a lot of moves that made a lot of sense on paper, Cozart included. And yet, you know, we talked about Cozart's hitting turning the corner, but he would actually have not performed that well this season offensively. He had an 83 OPS plus. You look at some of their other offseason additions. Ian Kinsler has an 85 OPS plus. Chris Young has a 77 OPS plus. And, you know, we can keep going through the names here. I mean, Justin Upton's been good, so that was one of the positives of their winner. But their offseason has not worked out as planned, and that's part of the reason they're in this predicament. Now, granted, you know, the Seattle Mariners deserve a lot of credit for having the monkey's paw, or whatever it is that's guided them to all these one-run victories and all these, you know, surprising seasons from guys like Wade LeBlanc and what have you. But yeah, it's kind of, even if the Mariners were not as good as they've been, we would probably be talking about the Angels being a disappointment for reasons other than their injuries, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't know about that, because I think the injuries play a big part in it. And yeah, they have some players who've had very disappointing seasons, but I really do think that there's enough time for this team to recover if they were getting all-star level performance from Shohei Ohtani, or if they were continuing to get a high level of performance from Cozart before his, you know, if he had regressed a little bit back to where he was in 2016 and 2017, instead of losing him for the season with injury. So I do think that the Angels would still kind of be in it. I mean, you know, keep in mind, they're still a team that's above 500, and they've managed to kind of keep treading water above that 500 mark despite all the injuries, which really says something. So the other thing is, if you look at kind of in the aggregate, the standings in the American League. You've got the Yankees and you've got the Mariners, who are class above everybody else, but then you get into this kind of muck of teams who are borderline 500, and that's basically the A's, the Angels, and the Rays. And I don't care how many injuries they have, I would still take the Angels over the Athletics or the Rays coming to the end of the season. Like, I definitely think that even with all this stuff going down, they still end up, you know, as the third team out of the division leaders going into the end of the season.
Yeah, I guess my point is more or less that we'd be talking about the disappointing performances on their team, because there have been a number of those.
So even though
the team record is solid, you could even say good based on all the injuries they've had, I do think, you know, we'd be paying more attention to how badly Cole Calhoun and Luis Valbuena and some of these other guys have performed. So I agree that, you know, even with the injuries, the Angels should be happy in the sense that they're not farther behind the standings. But I also just want to point out, I think I did say the A's would finish third when we did the preview, right? Didn't I have the A's over the Angels?
You definitely had the A's over the Angels, but I don't think you had them third. I thought you had them second.
I probably did have a second, because I didn't believe in the Mariners at all. So, all right, I was right, perhaps, about the A's being respectable, but I was wrong, because I thought the Mariners were going to get everyone fired. So, credit to them, and it just goes to show, even when I'm right, I'm actually wrong by a bigger margin. So,
I would,
anyway.
I don't know about that. The talking about, let's go back to the former Athletic, Josh Donaldson, and his setback with the Blue Jays. I really thought that if he had come back from injury and showed even flashes of his normal Josh Donaldson self, that the Blue Jays would look really aggressively to trade him at the deadline. I thought that was kind of going to be a given with Vlad Guerrero and Bo Bichette on the way. And I thought it would have brought back some talent, maybe as much talent as they gave up to get him originally from the Athletics, because that trade was a disaster. But I don't think this is going to happen now, and that makes it really disappointing for the Blue Jays, because I think that, you know, in general, of course, the season was a pretty huge disappointment for them so far, but he was their best chance to get some real value at the deadline. I think, you know, they'll move Happ or Estrada or somebody like that, but they're not going to bring back the kind of haul that Donaldson would have even for half a year.
So two questions here for you. One, would you offer Donaldson the qualifying offer?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, I would. No question, I would offer him the qualifying offer.
And you don't think he would take it? You think he's still going to get
that multi-year deal? That I'm a little unsure about, honestly. I don't think he will take the qualifying offer, because I think at least one team, will be willing to pay him a substantial amount more than the qualifying offer on a multi-year deal to slot him in as a regular third or first baseman. If I'm Josh Donaldson, maybe I take the qualifying offer and bet on myself for 2019.
Interesting. And my other question was, do you think the Jays at some point, perhaps even this winter, will shop Marcus Stroman and or Aaron Sanchez? I think both have had what we can term disappointing seasons, either due to injury or performance. You know, are the Jays basically going to hit the reset button and try to look 2 to 3 years down the road? Or do you think they're going to bring up Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bichette, and maybe even Alford, and, you know, if you want to throw another prospect name in there, by all means do so, and try to compete next season. So do you think, basically I'm just asking, do you think the Jays will enter this winter looking to compete in 2019, or do you think they're pushing their desires back to 2020, 2021 even?
It would not surprise me at all if the Jays feel like they can compete in 2019. It would not surprise me at all if they attempt to bring back close to the majors or already in the majors talent in the moves that they would make, whether it's trading Happ, Estrada, Sanchez for sure. I think they'll be a little more hesitant to move Stroman, because I think they need some sort of veteran leadership talent in their rotation, as you know, injury prone and disappointing as the season's been in some ways for him. So I wouldn't expect them to go whole hog and just gut the entire rotation, really kind of look at 2019 as a take a breath and try to hold out for 2020 season. It doesn't really seem like the Blue Jays' way. They haven't ever had that big reset in their recent history, and I don't really see Shapiro and company going that route. But I do see them moving some guys. I just think they might try to bring back a little bit more immediate talent in return, because Honestly, you know, if they replace Donaldson with Vlad Guerrero, Guerrero's the kind of prospect where I wouldn't expect them to lose a lot of performance for next year.
Right.
You know, some, but not a lot. He's ready to go, and he could very well be a 3-4-5 win player in his first season.
Yeah, I think they would probably lose it most on the defensive end, right?
Yeah,
because Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is not known for his glove, believe it or not, and he's probably going to be moved to a different corner position in the next 2 to 3 or 4 years, whatever they want to do. I don't know. They might move him to begin with. I don't know. Whatever keeps the service clock from ticking away.
Yeah, right.
And I think we've said basically all we can say on both the Cozart and Donaldson situations. So why don't we talk about some good news, that being the Los Angeles Dodgers got Clayton Kershaw back. But Dodgers have had a ton of injuries themselves. At one point, they had an entire starting rotation on the disabled list. And yet, for as disappointing as their season's been so far, they are 2.5 games out of first place, and it seems realistic to expect them to find a way to win this division. So what are your thoughts on the Dodgers and not only, you know, with their performance so far, but going forward now that they have Kershaw back in hand?
I think things look pretty okay for the Dodgers. This is a team that definitely needs to do something at the deadline, I think, and they're going to be kind of hamstrung in some ways, I think, because they do have this idea of trying to keep below the luxury tax mark. But I don't know. I'm not so high on the Diamondbacks at this point, even though they've got some guys ready to come off injury of their own. I mean, they have the second best left-handed pitcher in the American League, in the National League West, coming off of injury, and that's Robbie Ross.
Robbie Ray.
Yeah, Robbie Ross and Robbie Ray are two very different pitchers at this point in their careers.
It would be very impressive if it was Robbie Ross. We would be talking about him a lot more.
Yeah, sure would. Thank you for embarrassing me with that. And then, absolutely, I think the Dodgers are in it to win it. They've probably got to go get another piece, but it's really a testament to their depth that they've been able to hang on this far. Kershaw didn't look incredible in his first game back against the Mets. And, you know, it's the Mets. You're supposed to look pretty incredible there. But, I mean, he's Clayton Kershaw. I'm not that worried.
I agree. And I also think we should point out the Dodgers have succeeded so far based on some unexpected contributors. I mean, I don't think anyone expected Matt Kemp to be this good. I know he's suspended now, but he's been really, really good, hitting 311, 351, 539. That's a 141 OPS plus, which
that's
is the
all-star.
Highest. What was that?
I said that's an all-star.
Yes, it is, and it would be the highest OPS plus on the team, except for Jock Peterson as a 143 mark. And I don't know about you, but I thought Jock Peterson could be at the end of his leash in Los Angeles, especially late last season. In addition to those two, excuse me, he's not the highest on the team because Max Muncy has a 171 OPS plus. And Muncy is so interesting to me because he always had good plate discipline and he commands the strike zone. You know, it's a patient approach and all, but he's found power. And the problem with him when he was coming up through the system is he didn't have any thump whatsoever. And you couldn't justify playing him in a corner position or at DH because you figured pitchers weren't going to, you know, work around him. They weren't going to give him anything but strikes and make him burn them. And it wasn't clear that he could do that. And he didn't do that during his previous big league experience. Yet he's done that so far with the Dodgers, and I guess you have to note that he's improved his launch angle and his exit velocity. He's made some swing changes. I saw Eric Longenhagen point those out. I suppose, you know, that might be a legitimate gain, and if so, it's the second year in a row the Dodgers have kind of found a, if not a superstar-level performer, at least a star-level performer out of nothing. I mean, you know, last year, Chris Taylor, who, by the way, he's gotten going as well after a slow start. So I guess what I'm saying really is that Andrew Friedman is still pretty good at finding these hidden gems. And yeah, it's impressive, right?
Oh yeah, it's super impressive. I mean, again, you've got to tip your cap to the depth that the Dodgers are able to cultivate. I mean, coming into the season, Matt Kemp was kind of an afterthought. He was a guy that we kind of thought was going to be like, I don't know, fifth outfielder that they would roster and see if he had something left. And he's really turned out to be, you know, to start the season, he was really the focal point of the offense. And then Bellinger's been hitting like just phenomenally well recently. They have too much talent. You can't stop them. It's not. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I thought you were done. Sorry.
But the pitching still concerns me, and it always will. And I'm not sure it really should anymore. But if you're going to rely on Clayton Kershaw, Rich Hill, Alex Wood, and like you said, Ross Stripling. Kenta Maeda has been very good too. I'm less nervous about him, which is a crazy thing to say because Kenta Maeda has been such an injury risk even before he came to the States. But I do think they're going to want to get another starter in the mix. Somebody like, you know, their acquisition of Darvish, to shore up the rotation, to have it be another guy that they can be comfortable handing the ball to every fifth day, in order to really, you know, kind of make their final push, not even so much for the end of the season, but I think for the playoffs.
Yeah, and I want to go back to your point earlier when you said that it's going to be difficult for them in a sense, though, because of the luxury tax, you know. Mm-hmm. That's something that's true of basically every team in baseball. They're going to be very cognizant of their payroll number, and they're not going to necessarily want to go out here and make any, you know, a big splash because they don't want to, you know, cost themselves, handcuff themselves entering the winter. So I am very, very curious to see what they're going to do because, I mean, do you go out there and try to get half? Do you sacrifice, you know, all your careful financial planning, or, you know, are they going to be able to move a salary in order to get one of these guys? So I'm very curious from that perspective to see what exactly they do because I agree they need to get help, and I think that's true of, you know, most of these teams we're going to talk about heading up to the deadline. I mean, the exception is what, the Yankees maybe, the Astros maybe, and maybe the Red Sox as well. Otherwise, every team you're going to be talking about in these terms, and yet it's seemingly going to be a situation like what we're talking about here with the Dodgers, where, you know, you almost wonder, will they try to dump Logan Forsythe on someone so they can get away from the money and free up some cash to pursue a starting pitcher or what have you. So it's almost going to be an NBA-like situation here where you have to really, really take salary and contracts into account whenever we're considering one of these potential trades.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think Forsythe is a good option. The Dodgers have enough minor league depth that they can get somebody to take on Forsythe's, what is it, an $8.5 million option that he's got for this year. Or yeah. I think Yasmani Grandal is a likely trade candidate as well, just because I know they really value him, but I think that if they could significantly upgrade in another area, I think they'd be okay rolling with the guys that they've got in Austin Barnes and some of their AAA depth. But yeah, it's a puzzle, actually. It's a legitimate, you know, I don't know how they would make that work kind of situation because they have so much money tied up in a couple of these players like Jansen and Turner and, of course, Clayton Kershaw, who we talked about earlier. And maybe it could be something where they want to move on from Puig. I think that might be something. But they've got a couple of guys in Puig and Grandal who there are teams that would definitely be interested in taking on those contracts for those types of players.
Absolutely. And it's kind of funny because the team who comes to mind with Grandal, the Nationals. And I don't think that the Dodgers would trade him to the Nationals for obvious reasons. So unless, maybe there's some interesting challenge trade those two teams could find where the Nationals send a starting pitcher and in exchange get Grandal. But I'm struggling to think of one off the top of my head.
I was going to say Tanner Roark. I don't think the Nationals
are in position to do it. Oh, yeah. Wow. I don't think the Nationals would do that, though, do you?
No, I don't think so, and I don't think Tanner Roark's the type of pitcher that the Dodgers would be super interested in anyway.
Yeah, so maybe Gio Gonzalez, but why would the Nationals move Gio Gonzalez at this point?
No, I can't see them doing that. Yeah, you're right.
So that'll be fun to watch. Something that's not fun to watch is another group of marquee players going on the disabled list. Chris Bryant, hip DL, with some shoulder soreness. Gary Sanchez is on the DL with a groin strain. And then Caleb Smith. Yes, Caleb Smith is getting lumped in with Chris Bryant and Gary Sanchez because he seemed like he could have made the All-Star game as the Marlins representative due to his performance this season. He's dealing with a lat muscle issue. Bryant's probably, seemingly at least, going to be the one who's out for the shortest amount of time, with Sanchez probably missing a month. And then Smith probably going to be a little bit longer than that, depending on exactly how he recovers. So, Brian, I'll just go ahead and ask you, what are your thoughts on each of these injuries?
So, the Bryant injury, I actually think is probably the most interesting, even though it's not a super severe injury, because the Cubs are in a dogfight for that National League Central with the Brewers and the Cardinals. Again, I'm kind of shocked that the Cardinals are in it as much as they are at this point, but that's what the Cardinals do. But what this injury kind of does for the Cubs is I think it makes us really have to sit and see, are they going to give Ian Happ some playing time with Bryant out of the picture for a little bit? And if they do, is he really going to emerge as the type of everyday player hitter that some of us thought he would be? Or is he really going to emerge as the type of player who this team's going to trade to get somebody else in, whether another pitcher or some other kind of asset for this team, whether it's at the deadline or maybe next offseason or something like that? You know, fortunately, Ben Zobrist has reverted to being a perfectly suitable Ben Zobrist again recently, which is really nice. I'm really happy to see that. And Javier Baez has gotten into one of his modes where he just becomes an incredible force for a short period of time. He's been just lights out. So the Cubs, it doesn't really worry me, even though it's Chris Bryant and he is the engine that makes this this offense go. It doesn't super worry me, but I think it's going to give us a clear picture of maybe seeing what the Cubs have and what they're going to need to do to try to overtake the Brewers.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I agree that the onus right now is on Ian Happ. And in the games that Bryant has missed, Happ has started in center field, at third base twice, at center field twice, third base twice, and at first base to give Anthony Rizzo a day off. And, you know, it's kind of curious because we talked about in our preseason show how Happ was too good to be a bench player.
Yeah.
And I think that's still true. He's an above average hitter. He's a switch hitter, but he's better against right-handed pitching than left-handed pitching. So you're really talking about a guy who, he's basically a never left-handed bat in your lineup. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I just have to feel like they're going to have to find a way to get him into the lineup consistently, but I'm having trouble figuring out how to do that now that Zobrist is back. You know, they're not going to give up on Hayward, and to his credit, he's shown signs of life this season. Albert Almora Jr. has really, really blossomed into a nice player. I mean, when he was coming up, the hope was that he would become sort of like Jackie Bradley Jr. He's better than Jackie Bradley Jr. He's a legitimate starting center fielder. So that's been an interesting development. And yeah, I don't know. Where do you get Happ into this lineup? Because they clearly love Kyle Schwarber. And Schwarber, to his credit, is back to hitting. So I don't know how Happ really fits in unless there's a move that they're going to make or unless they're just going to keep him around for depth purposes and, you know, juggle him around and find a way to get him his 400-plus plate appearances each season. But it still seems like a waste to me. So I don't know. That's the most interesting thing about the Cubs there is, I think, right now. Just do they use Happ to solidify their rotation? You know, what could they get for him and what they do if they keep him?
And you could definitely see reasons why the Cubs or even an acquiring team would put up their hands and say, hey, there's kind of some warning signs here with Happ. I mean, he's struck out 37.6% of the time this season.
Yeah.
He's always had a high strikeout rate, and he offsets it very well. He has a high on-base percentage despite all the strikeouts because he's had such a remarkably good walk rate this year. But if you look at it, he's a 3-2 true outcomes player. I mean, he's had 229 plate appearances. When you factor in the fact that he's had 86 strikeouts, 36 walks, and 9 homers, he's a 50% true outcomes guy. And some teams really don't love to have that in their lineup. And I don't know if that's something the Cubs are particularly going to care about too much, but it may limit his market a little bit. You know, acquiring teams may look at that and say, well, you know, we want somebody who's going to put the ball in play a little bit more. And I think that's, whether that's a good argument not to acquire somebody or not is an open point for discussion, but you can see where his game is and, you know, not really having a defensive position yet, why teams might be like, well, maybe we're not going to give the Cubs exactly what they want for him, so the Cubs hold on to him because they can't get what they would consider equivalent value.
Yeah, and I would say that the flip side of that, just to play devil's advocate for a second here, is that maybe you look at Happ and say, perhaps with more consistent playing time, you know, he would be able to reel in the strikeouts a little bit and perhaps be a better overall player, although, you know, it doesn't seem like his swing and miss issues are going to go away. The question is whether he's going to be a 30% strikeout guy, or like a 35% strikeout guy, because it's very, very difficult to be a consistently above average hitter when you're striking out 35% of the time. I mean,
yeah, that's
almost impossible. You have to hit for power, you have to walk a lot, you have to basically be perfect when you're not striking out. And you know, we're not even talking about the pop-ups he hits. I believe his pop-up rate is, if it's not league average, it might be above league average. So there are a lot of, let's say, easy outs, so to speak, with Happ, and not a lot of in-play outs. So
yeah, well,
there's definitely risk there.
The thing about Happ that's so fascinating right now is for the season, he's got a .381 BABIP. Despite those pop-ups, You know, he's got a very high BABIP, and his batting average is still only 240.
That doesn't even take into account the home runs.
Right.
Wow, that's crazy. So that's basically 40% of his balls in play go for hits, even though he's popping up, it looks like 12% of the time, which is league average rate. So, you know, kudos to Ian Happ, because that's kind of remarkable that he's been as productive as he has with that strikeout rate.
Well, I mean, it's exactly what you said. It's you have to kind of be perfect to be a productive hitter with that strikeout rate, and he kind of has.
Yeah. Yeah. So kudos to him, and very interesting player. I certainly hope he gets the strikeouts under order, because I think he could be a pretty fun player to watch for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years or what have you.
I don't disagree with you at all. I think if he went to a team that was going to play him every day and leave him at one position consistently, I think you'd see a difference. I think you would see some improvement as he was able to focus in. But, you know, that's just speculation on my part.
Let's talk about a young player we mentioned earlier who does play most every day and who may or may not have shown some improvement. And I'm talking about Gary Sanchez. Because he's had a disappointing season, I think. I feel like I've said disappointing 1,000 times already this episode. I'm disappointed in myself for my word choices so far. But Sanchez has hit 190, 291, 433. That's a 93 OPS plus. And he's continued to hear about his blocking ability or inability, if you are a member of the New York press or fan base, all season long. And, of course, the Yankees are now turning to Austin Romine, who, in addition to having a fluky-looking, surprisingly good offensive line this season, has the backup catcher's reputation of being very good with the staff, being very good at the defensive things that make the world turn around, I guess. I don't know what I'm going with there. But, you know, the Sanchez injury, this is probably a good thing for him in a sense, right? Because now he can maybe mentally reset and perhaps find himself back to being, you know, the slugger in the middle of the order of course that we thought he was prior to this year, excuse me.
So I am going to say no. I disagree with that very much. So when you say he's had a disappointing season, I can totally understand why that would be the perception, that he's had a disappointing season. He's hitting 190. He's not reaching base 3 times out of 10. At the same time, he's been something close to a league average hitter despite that, which is incredible. He's got those 14 homers. He's still walking. His strikeout rate hasn't changed dramatically from what we would expect it to be. So yeah, this is a disappointing season for him. In a disappointing season, he is still a well above average catcher. Between his offensive production and the fact that, you're right, his blocking is not good, and it's going to consistently draw some criticism. But his framing is good enough to pretty much make up for it, I think. So, yeah, he's been having a disappointing season, but that's only because he has set the bar so high for his performance. He is basically expected to put out Buster Posey-type overall performance, and he hasn't done that this season because he hasn't hit well enough for that. But although Austin Romine has been playing pretty well, this is in no way a good thing, I think, for anybody. I think Gary Sanchez might have reset, unless he has another injury that needs some rest. I think he would have eventually reset at the plate anyways and kind of reverted something closer to his previous level of offensive performance. Being without him for a month is going to be a blow for the Yankees, I think.
Well, I agree that it's not a good thing from a team perspective. I suppose I was trying to find the silver lining there. And yeah, Sanchez is a very good player, and I use disappointing in regards to, you know, what we think of when we expect Sanchez's performance. You know, so I guess it's just disappointing within the context of Gary Sanchez.
Because yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And I just want to, for the record, talk a little bit about catchers this season. And so only a few catchers have, quote, your qualified plate appearances, and Sanchez has not been the best hitting catcher of the bunch. He's been probably the worst, behind guys like Wilson Ramos and Wilson Contreras, pretty much anybody named Wilson, Buster Posey, Yasmani Grandal. He's even hitting worse in aggregate when accounting for league and park than Tucker Barnhart. But still, nobody takes the you know, nobody is a catcher who plays as often as Sanchez seems to. Very few guys, and very few guys put up his level of performance, and especially when you combine the fact with the fact that he's a good defender. So teams should be so lucky to have catchers of his quality, even in a down year.
I agree with that. It feels like we're sort of going to have Sanchez play out Mike Piazza's career. Because if you remember, Piazza, I mean, he got bashed repeatedly for his defense. And then you look at some of the advanced metrics on him now, and he was actually a pretty good defender based on what we judge now versus back in the day. So I wonder if Sanchez is going to be sort of the sequel to that, where he's, you know, an outstanding offensive catcher, and then he gets more flack for his defense than he deserves because he's not viewed as a quote-unquote well-rounded catcher. He's just viewed as a slugger. And, you know, I think his body type plays into this too, right? He's a big dude. I feel like if you're a smaller guy, you sort of get a maybe like a mental boost that, oh, he must be a good defender because he's kind of smaller. Whereas bigger catchers, and I would include like Nick Hundley in this and maybe Tyler Flowers, Ryan McCann. If you're a bigger catcher, I feel like you almost, Matt Wieters as well, you almost have to be just perfect at everything. Otherwise, people are going to say, well, they should move him to first base. They should move him to DH because he's never going to be, you know, a good defensive catcher. Do you agree with that? Do you think there's any bias against big catchers?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very apt comparison, comparing him to Piazza. I mean, of course, Piazza had the arm issues, and Gary Sanchez does not have arm issues. That's not his problem. But yeah, you're right that there's nits to pick about his defense, and people probably over-emphasize them because he's such a great hitter. And it's the rule is that if you can't hit as a catcher, you're assumed to be a good defender. If you can't hit, you're assumed to be a bad defender.
Yeah, and Austin Romine, by the way, Nichols Law applies to him because even with his good 100 plate appearances this season and 711 career plate appearances, he has a 65 OPS plus. So I think the metrics think that Romine is at least an average catcher. I did not check honestly because, you know, it's Austin Romine.
Yeah, who cares?
But yeah, he's not Jeff Mathis back there. You know, just to name a name. He's not, basically what I'm saying is he's not an elite level defender by basically any definition other than the definition that, oh, he cannot hit at all, so he must be very, very good behind the plate.
Yeah, Baseball Prospectus's framing numbers had him do very well last season with about 6.3 framing runs, but his minor league stats, he's had some good numbers in extended time, and he's got some good numbers. He's already got 2.5 framing runs this season, so he's certainly not a bad defender back there statistically. He does have a very good reputation, though, and I think that plays into, you know, everything that goes into him getting some extra playing time.
Yeah, so let's talk about a former Yankee now, and it's one that I'm surprised we're lumping in here with the All-Stars, but it's justified at this point, and that's Caleb Smith. In 16 starts this season, he had a 4.19 ERA, that's an 88 ERA plus, and he had struck out 10.2 batters for 9, almost a 2.7 strikeout-to-walk ratio. That's also a 3.9 FIP. I'm sure Brian can fill us in on his DRA. But Caleb Smith is on the disabled list with a grade 3 lat strain. He's apparently going to miss the rest of the season, which is a very disappointing outcome, because he's been one of the brightest spots on the Marlins.
Yeah, and like you said, his DRA is right in line with his FIP. It's a 3.9 DRA. He's always been kind of a strikeout guy. I did not expect the strikeouts to jump up and the control to improve somewhat when moving into a starting role. And like I think we've seen in him in the past, he's very much a fly ball guy. The move from the Yankees to the Marlins, if you're a fly ball guy, is a pretty significant one.
Absolutely.
So I think that's really helping him out, but you can't say anything other, I think, than just you got to tip your cap at this point. Whatever he's doing is working very well, and of course it cost him an injury with that lat injury, but he was one of the few things that the Marlins have done recently that didn't look idiotic in hindsight.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's fair, though. What else can you point to, really? Because this roster, you know, it's funny because we talked about this during the preview of how bad this team was and how they're just going to be lifeless and all. And earlier in the season, I saw some people chest beating a little bit, like, oh, they weren't as bad as people expected, blah, blah, blah. And here we sit. We are halfway through the season, I think, for most teams. They are 32-49. And if you do the math on that, that works out to about a 64-win pace. So they have overachieved in the sense that they're not the worst team in history of baseball. But we're talking about a 64-win pace as being like a huge surprise, or at least somewhat of a surprise. So that kind of says it all about, you know, the state of this team, the state of this franchise. Because, man, there's really not a ton to grab hold of right now, is there?
Well, and the craziest thing, I agree with you. You're absolutely right. But the craziest thing here is the players that the Marlins traded away. If they would have retained those players, your Stanton, Ozuna, Yelich, if they would have retained two of those players, I think this team would be out there competing at least for a wild card spot. Because the guys who have done well have been guys that they would have retained otherwise, and the guys they've gotten in return are obviously very far off. You know, Yelich has been playing well. Stanton is still Mike Stanton, and he's still, you know, an MF-er. I mean, like, this is so strange to me, because the guys who've kind of emerged from this team are your Caleb Smith. Brian Anderson's had a really nice season. You could leave him at third base instead of moving him to the outfield, because your outfield is such garbage, if you had some of these other outfielders that the Marlins had last year. They would still need pitching. That's not a question. But I went and saw a Marlins game in Miami a couple of weeks ago, and this is a team that has to run out there a bunch of guys who don't look like they should be major league regulars. And that's where the real problem is with this team. And they wouldn't have that problem if they just retained D. Gordon and Christian Yelich and Giancarlo Stanton. I mean, trade away one of the three of them. That doesn't matter. But it's just they kind of brought this ineffectiveness on themselves.
Yeah. And I want to note two things. One, Lewis Brinson has been horrendous. I mean, so awful, awful. And there's no reason to move him down. I don't think he should be demoted because, you know, he's not going to benefit from more time in AAA. But he's been very, very bad. And if you haven't been keeping up with that Marlins team at all, check out his numbers just from the sense that, wow, that's unexpectedly bad for him. And the other thing, I actually think the Marlins could be an interesting player at the deadline when it comes to their bullpen. They have Kyle Barrickall. They have Drew Steckenrider. They have even Adam Conley. I think we talked about Adam Conley last year when he was demoted. We were both kind of fond of Adam Conley. He's came back, and in 16 innings as a reliever, has struck out about 10 per 9. He's only walked 2 per 9. He has a 2.29 ERA plus and a 3.22 FIP. He's been pretty effective, albeit in a small sample. So I think they could go out there, conceivably move some of these guys. And I know the reaction when you talk about moving a guy like Barrickall is like, why? Because he's still early in his service time clock. You know, he's not going to be a free agent for years and years to come. He's already 28 years old. This is his age 28 season. He's not a baby. You know, it's conceivable that he blows out his arm in a year or two and, you know, they get nothing back. So I think they should at least take a look at that and see if they can, shake it up a little bit. And I'll also add, because of the conversation we had earlier when it comes to the luxury tax and how teams are going to be trying to avoid that shopping a guy like Barrickall, who's still early on in the earning process, mm-hmm. would make a ton of sense. You might actually get more in return for him than you would expect because of the fact that he fits so nicely into so many of these competing teams' budgets. So if I were running the Marlins, I think I would look at that, even if it means that our bullpen's going to be bad, as in addition to our rotation being bad, and that we're going to have some very ugly scores put up against us the rest of the season, because realistically, this team is, 5 years away from being competitive at minimum? I mean,
yeah, at the very least, they're 2 years away from being 2 years away.
exactly.
Exactly. And at that Marlins game I went to, it was the Marlins versus the Padres, which, let me tell you, if I could have picked a different game, I would have. But they brought in Brad Ziegler late in the game. The Marlins actually ended up winning 4-0, but they brought in Brad Ziegler late in the game with a runner on, and he did his patented throw one pitch, get a double play, walk off the field. And just the entire time, like for the next full inning, I was just kind of nodding knowingly going, yep, this is exactly the type of guy that some team is going to want to pick up at the deadline, because his ability to do that, you know, like one out of every two or three times he comes into a game it's valuable, man. And I know he makes a little bit more money than somebody like Barrickall, but being a vet, being a guy who's very, very able to slot into a very specific role in a bullpen, there's no reason for the Marlins to hold on to a guy like that.
Yeah, and the Padres are another team who could shake up the relief market. Everybody talks about Brad Hand, but they also have Salmon, your boy.
Yeah.
Kirby Yates. I mean, look, I was wrong about Kirby Yates. I thought he was an up and down reliever. I would be trading him immediately because of his health history and because he's a 31-year-old with a 0.82 ERA, a 4.44 strikeout to walk ratio. He'd be the guy I'd deal, and he still fits into a lot of these teams' budgets. Nothing against him. It's just the argument I made for trading Blake Parker at last year's deadline. Like, look, he's not a long-term asset. Like, most relievers are not long-term assets, but guys in their 30s who are having phenomenal seasons and you're not competitive, I think you got to move them. I think you got to move all of them, basically. And if the league is still obsessed with the whole, bullpenning thing or whatever you want to call it in terms of, stacking your bullpen for the postseason, then get on the phone with Cleveland and try to move some of these guys because you might get something better than you expect in return for them.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. And the Padres have, like, legitimate depth in their bullpen, which is, it's the only place they have depth, but they've got depth. the Adam Simber has looked okay at times, pretty good at times. He hasn't been doing quite as well recently, but Matt Strom has just moved into their bullpen, and I don't know if they'll move him eventually back into the rotation, but he's got some talent.
Robbie Irwin.
I don't even want to talk about Robbie Irwin, man.
Love Robbie Irwin.
I did too. I used to love this guy, and it's wild because he is by far the longest tenured Padre on this team, which is a bizarre thing to think about because I think he's thrown something like 120 innings for the team, period. like he and Corey Spangenberger, like the old men of this Padres team, which is just bizarre to think about. But yeah, and while we're on the subject of the Padres, do you want to talk briefly about their bullpen and who they've brought up from the minors recently?
Yeah, I guess we could do that. And the name is probably familiar to many of you. And if not, you probably haven't been following along with the draft for very long because they brought up a fellow named Robert Stock. And for those who may not know who Robert Stock is, back when he was a prep player, he went to University of South California earlier than expected. I think he was 17 when he enrolled, I believe. I don't have the exact story in front of me here, but he was a big deal and he was a catcher. And he was drafted by the Cardinals, spent years and years in their system, toiling. He was converted to pitching, didn't get a chance there. He kind of bounced around a little bit. He was with Pittsburgh system, went to Cincinnati system, and then this year he's with the Padres, and in 28 minor league appearances, he's got a 1.95 ERA, a strikeout rate about 11 per 9. He is a little wild, walks about 4 per 9, but, I mean, considering his story and considering that he's still relatively new to pitching, pretty impressive. So they brought Stock up, and he's made 2 appearances so far, an inning and 2/3, 4 hits, a run, 3 strikeouts, and a hit batsman. Anything you want to add on Stock? Because I have not gotten a chance to see his appearances yet, so I need to go to Brooks Baseball to give you a scouting report on what he throws. I know he throws hard, but I don't know how hard.
His debut went about as well as you could have asked any pitcher's major league debut to go. Struck out 2, faced 4 batters, gave up a hit, and looked like basically the most dominant closer that you could ask for. It didn't go so well his second game, which was against Texas in Texas, which is kind of a tough road to hoe anyway. He's not much of anything other than I don't want to say a sideshow because that undersells how well he's pitched in the minor leagues this year, but he is the type of guy who you think could have a lot of success or could not. He's basically a pretty standard middle reliever guy at this point in his career, but it's a great story and I really hope he finds some success. And one of the best places to do it is in San Diego, of course.
Yeah. He throws 98 miles per hour. Like he sits at 98 miles per hour. So he's basically Teron Guerrero, but yeah, actually still on the Padres. So I guess that's a comparison we can make there. Earlier, we were talking about how Robbie Irwin was one of our favorites. Let's move on to another guy who I think we both quite liked in the past. That would be Lucas Duda. He is back in the Royals lineup after missing a fair amount of time. I believe it was with plantar fasciitis. Could be wrong on that one. But Duda, he's been disappointing for almost a full year now. He was solid enough with the Mets last season, and then he was traded to the Rays for another guy who just reached the majors, and Carson Smith. And from that point forward, he's been a little bit below a league average hitter, which isn't a great sign when you're a platoon first baseman who isn't great defensively. So Duda's probably coming up at the end of his usefulness as a big league player, I think. And it's a disappointing outcome for the Royals because when they signed him, it seemed like a smart bet to, you know, perhaps have him bounce back and shop him at this deadline. I'm not sure if they're going to be able to get anything here for him other than maybe a flyer. And even then, I'm not sure. I really don't think he has a ton of value anymore, do you?
Yeah, it's – well, I mean, I think this offseason taught us that he does not have a ton of value because of the way that the market kind of looked at all of these first base DH-only types. I mean, you saw that there was not what you would call a bull market for these types of players. Duda's problems really have to do with the fact that when he is not hitting for power the way he normally does, he has these kind of ebbs and flows in his power, and when he's not hitting for power – pitchers will challenge him in the zone a little bit more often, and if he can't capitalize on that, he doesn't get the benefit of his stellar approach where he walks a lot. Because he's a big walk guy. That's how he gets on base. He is not a make contact guy. So this is a lot like his 2016 season with the Mets, which was also an injury-plagued season. At this point, you have to be really cognizant of the fact that he's going to be injured a lot of the time. He's not going to be a dominant offensive force. He's the type of platoon offensive player where you expect him to be like 20% better than league average, not 50% better than league average. So yeah, he's a really limited part at this point. Now, the one thing is that when he's had instances like this before and come back from them. So I think that it's still possible that teams are going to take flyers on him and see if he can hit a run where he's really hitting for some power. But it also doesn't do him any favors to be a power guy trying to play in Kansas City. So that's tough, too.
Do you think he shudders when he hears the name Adam Wend?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I would not be surprised at all to see him in more of an Adam Wend role next year. So, yeah.
Adam Wend can't even find an Adam Wend role, though, at this point.
Adam Lind 2017, not Adam Lind 20. You know, Lucas Duda could have Adam Lind's 2017 next year, and then his 2018 the year after that, where he can't find work.
No, I know. I just meant like, even though Adam Lind just had that phenomenal season last year in that role, he couldn't even find that role again this winter.
Yeah.
So it's rough sledding out there if you're a defensively challenged platoon corner player at this point.
Unless you're Jose Bautista.
Unless you're Jose Bautista, then you have friends in high places, apparently.
And you somehow get every opportunity to play both the outfield and third base, so good for him.
Yep, and another good story here is that Shelby Miller is back from Tommy John surgery. Clay Buchholz, meanwhile, went to the disabled list with a strained oblique, so this seems like a boost for the Diamondbacks rotation, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And between getting Robbie Ray back as well, I think that we're in for a fight in the National League West, and it's going to be fun to watch. Although, to be fair, with Shelby Miller, you just don't know how he's going to come back.
Yeah, and he did not pitch well in his first game back. 3 2/3 innings, 6 hits, 5 runs, all earned, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. One other injury I think we wanted to touch on here that has some big league ramifications, even if it occurred to a player who has never appeared in the majors, is that Nick Senzel, the top prospect in the Cincinnati Reds organization and a guy who ended the season ranked 7th on basically every list, Baseball Prospectus, Baseball America, and MLB.com, is out for the year. He tore a tendon in his finger, and that's disappointing for a number of reasons, beginning with the fact that we don't get to see him this year. We kept waiting on him to appear. He missed some time due to vertigo. He performed well since coming back. And, you know, he's a well-rounded player. They had him playing the middle infield in addition to third base as a means of perhaps grooming him to take a spot in the big league lineup that wasn't already occupied by Eugenio Suarez, rather. And yet, we're not going to see him until 2019. And, you know, based on their inclination to suppress his service time, we're probably not going to see Senzel until maybe June of next year, you think?
Yeah, I think that's about right. At what point he'll be 23. I think he's, you know, able to be an average to above average major league third baseman or second baseman today if he wasn't injured. So it's disappointing we won't get to see him for a while. I'm not sure we were going to anyway with the way that the Reds are bad and want to keep his service time down. So I'm not very certain that things would have worked out exactly the way we want it. Senzel's birthday is tomorrow. He will turn 23 tomorrow, which is Thursday, Friday, excuse me, if you're listening to this on Friday. So today. But that means he'll be, I've really botched this one, but that means he'll almost be 24 when he's ready to come up, which means he's kind of getting a late start. And it's a shame because he is a really, really polished hitter. And I think it's going to translate really well to the major league level. It's just that he'll kind of end up getting a later start to his career than he probably deserves.
And man, that's depressing right there, that we basically have gotten to this point where if it comes to, you know, manipulating service time and trying to avoid the Super 2 threshold, where we're talking about arguably a top five prospect in baseball. I think he has to be top five at this point, maybe top three, depending on your read of the situation. And we're talking about him not due to injury not coming up this season, but you didn't think he was going to come up even if he had stayed healthy, right? Is that?
I think he would have been a September call-up, but yeah.
That's horrible. I mean, he hit 310, 378, 509 this season in AAA. That's in almost 200 plate appearances. And yes, he's missed time with the vertigo. Yes, he's trying to learn new positions. But if we're at this point where teams are just willing to basically punt half a season of, you know, bringing a guy up when he's deserving, then we are so far past the acceptability threshold here. I mean, not that I want these guys, suppressing their service time and their earning potential to begin with, but we're getting to a point where you have to almost wish the league stepped in and did something about this. Of course, they're not going to because they're the ones who benefit from it. But man, that's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's really not fun for us. It's really not fair to the players because Senzel is probably going to, as a result, lose out on, at least a good chunk of major league money, at least per diems, even at the $550,000 major league minimum level. He's going to miss out on a year of being able to pad his statistics, a year of pension, all that good stuff.
Yeah, and it makes me think almost of when Shohei Ohtani was signed. Someone was like, they're going to use the spring to justify sending him down and suppressing him so he doesn't hit Super 2. And I thought it was a joke, and it turned out to be a joke. But I'm not going to lie, part of me was like, you know what? That might actually happen nowadays. 10 years ago, that's when Super 2 started to get popular. And maybe someone should do an article on this. When did Super 2 become like a mainstream and an accepted thing? Because I remember with the Evan Longoria suppression, that's when it started to become, sort of a thing that quote-unquote smart analysts talked about is, they're going to hold him down for an extra few months and get that extra year, get it a little cheaper too. And nowadays it feels like it's just an accepted thing. Like fans are just like, no, don't bring him up early. We don't want to have to pay him more. And it's like, well, why? Why wouldn't you want the player getting paid what it's worth?
Well, and I mean, tell me the reason why Vladimir Guerrero Jr. shouldn't be in the major leagues right now.
Oh, his defense is horrible, Brian. Lord forbid the Blue Jays had a guy who can hit the car, hit the cover off the ball. I mean, they certainly couldn't use that. They certainly have, no qualms about bringing guys like Gio Urshela and Russ Martin, who have never played shortstop on a consistent basis, at least at the big league level, and running them out at shortstop. But Lord forbid they bring up their, phenom of a teenager and let him, stroke dongs and all that good stuff. That would be horrible.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real here. Vlad Guerrero now is hitting .407, .457, .667 in Double A, with 11 home runs. He's not striking out at all. I really like Curtis Granderson, but they should fire him into the sun if it means that you can get Vlad Guerrero in the lineup. I mean, it's not rocket science. In that particular metaphor, it is rocket science. Yep. But I mean, I really like Andrés Solarte. Justin Smoke is a valuable part of this team. Kendrys Morales does exist, despite all evidence to the contrary. Get them all out of here. Someone has to go so that you can play what's likely to be the best 19-year-old player to enter Major League Baseball since Bryce Harper. You do it.
Yeah. It's also interesting because, this isn't just affecting the players. This is also affecting the game. For obvious reasons, we're not seeing as many talented youngsters come up and entertain us, which is a shame because, Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, those guys came up young, and they're some of the best players in the game. But also, this is going to affect, record chases and all. If you're manipulating guys until they're 24, 25, you're probably going to see fewer Hall of Fame careers, right?
Yeah, probably. And even if you're not looking at it from the long-term perspective and you're just looking at it from the short-term perspective, the aging curve for Major League Baseball players has shifted so that younger players are putting up more value than they had been in the past. Younger players are better now. So even for an immediate value perspective, chances are you're going to want to stock your team with younger players rather than older players because they're providing more of the value these days. And, you know, a guy like, there's literally no one in baseball who thinks, oh, we're going to promote Vlad Guerrero from AA and he's not going to hit all right. Like, he may have some slow starts and things like that. I mean, not everybody comes in and hits, you know, to their absolute maximum their first year in there. But I don't think anybody thinks Vlad Guerrero is going to get called up and, like, not hit 300.
Right. And even if he doesn't, you know, even if he struggles a little bit, that's acceptable.
Yeah,
right?
We're not
at the point where if you struggle a little bit when you get called up, you should be discarded or whatever. I think we saw that. I mean, when Trout, when he came up, he struggled a little bit. And then, you know, a year later, a year and a half later, he's the best player in baseball. It has been since. So,
but are you going to tell me, like, the Blue Jays are like, nope, we got to commit to getting Devin Travis in the lineup every day? Like, that okay. is it. We know that's a joke. We know that's not true.
Yeah, and they know we know that's a joke, and they still do it. So I don't know. Something's got to change because if Senzel had stayed healthy and he had not appeared in the majors this season, I mean, the Union should have been. Oh man, it's a mess, and it makes the product worse. All to save teams, what, a couple million?
Yeah,
it's not worth it. It's not worth it at all, and it's a shame that it's come to this.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about a change that we can get excited about. Something that has changed, and we can get excited about that change, and that's Edwin Jackson making it back to the major leagues with the Oakland Athletics. Edwin Jackson now ties Octavio Dotel for the most different teams to appear for in Major League Baseball. Edwin Jackson is a personal concern for both of us. We both really appreciate and enjoy him and his journeys throughout baseball. So, RJ, tell me about EJax and how excited you are that he got his first Major League start of the season for the Athletics.
Oh, I'm thrilled. And, you know, the thing is, when we talked about Edwin Jackson in the past, people have said, oh, you know, realistically, he's probably not going to contribute much, but it's cool to see him back. You know, he's still kind of young considering, considering it feels like he's been around forever. And he has been around a very long time, but that's because he debuted on like his 19th birthday. And he's only in his age 34 season now. But here's the thing. The Edwin Jackson promotion went from being kind of funny and kind of cool for novelty purposes to being potentially very interesting because he went out there and he had a quality start. 6 innings, 6 hits, a run, 7 strikeouts, 0 walks. And also, he was showing off velocity that we're not used to Edwin Jackson showing off.
Nope.
I mean, just based on that one start, he averaged 94.4 miles per hour. Well, the last time Edwin Jackson averaged 94.4 miles per hour was, August of 2015. So beyond that, I believe he was also topping off higher than we've seen him in a number of years. And I just want to make sure of that before I say it. Well, okay, he topped out at 96 miles per hour for rookie baseball. Previously, 97 miles per hour. So that's about in line where he usually topped off in the past. But basically, Edwin Jackson did not look like he was at the end of his line, and he didn't pitch like it either. So hopefully...
He looked like Devil Rays Edwin Jackson, which is really kind of saying something.
Yeah, and, you know, to the A's credit, they've had some luck with guys like Trevor Cahill, kind of finding the fountain of youth out there. So hopefully Eddie Jack pitches well enough to earn at least one more deal. And I don't know, I'm rooting for the guy. And my favorite story concerning Edwin Jackson comes from a Joe LeMayer piece on him. And I think this is after he threw a no-hitter or whatever. And when the Rays traded him to the Tigers, Andrew Friedman called him and thanked him for his service and told him he'd been traded. And he hung up, and Jackson realized he did not tell me where he had been traded to. Now, you or I, or, you know, most people, we probably text Friedman or call him and be like, hey, you know, you're literally talking about my future. Where did you trade me to? And Jackson was apparently so polite that he didn't want to bother Friedman because he knew he was busy. And that is just an amazing story, isn't it? Because how many ball players, you know, I mean, Edwin Jackson at that point was an established player. Like, he was a half year away from making an all-star team. I wasn't a huge believer in him at the time. But, yeah, he had talent. He was, you know, a top prospect during his day, blah, blah, blah. Like, he had enough under his belt where he would have absolutely been justified calling and saying, like, where did you trade me to? And yet he was just like, no, he's too busy. I don't want to bother him. That's crazy.
Yeah, that is really, really cool. I do have one quick anecdote about Edwin Jackson. I was at Sabre Seminar last year, and they asked a bunch of people who their favorite Edwin Jackson teammate was. And I find it I jumped in with, I thought my favorite teammate of Edwin Jackson's was Ricky Henderson, which is astonishing that they played on the same team. They both played for the 2003 Dodgers at the same time.
That's crazy.
This is my favorite thing now is that Edwin Jackson is the bridge because he played with Ricky Henderson and with Bryce Harper. That's astonishing to me.
That is, wow. So, I mean, the guy is just like a walking fun fact. And again, he seems like a legitimately good guy based on everything out there. And he's been with enough teams that, you know, maybe you think, oh, there's something wrong with his personality. But I've never heard a bad word about Edwin Jackson. And this is not a situation like, I'm not going to name any names. But, you know, some guys bounce around because the team's tired. Well, let's just say, you know Escobar. Guys get tired of him. This is not a you know Escobar situation. This is just a guy who, unfortunately, you know, his performance is leave him on the bubble. But seems like a good guy. And that is incredible. Ricky Henderson and Bryce Harper in one career.
Yeah, if you look at the types of the players that he's played with in his career, because he's gone to so many different teams, I mean, there's just a laundry list of current Hall of Famers, future Hall of Famers, just so many different types of players that he's played with. This is a guy who's played with Jeff Kent. He's also a guy who's played with Chris Bryant. Like, it's just absolutely fascinating to me. If you look at his career, just the breadth of different guys he's played with, you know, he's played with, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, you know, going back to his laundry list of teams he's played for, since he played in Tampa Bay, he's of course, you know, played with Evan Longoria, and he's played with, I probably matched up with Miguel Cabrera in Detroit, I would think.
I believe so. Then he played with Pujols in St. Louis, as well as Jadier and Holiday and Berkman. Also, where he needs to sign next year, right?
Give it to me. Where does he need?
The Angels.
Well, that would be great. That would give him, you know, the Harper, Trout, Bryant. You know, he would really get a lot of those. That's a really good one. I mean, this guy's played with Nomar Garciaparra. He's played with Kenny Lofton. I mean, he hasn't. I was off on my 2006 Dodgers when he left the team in 2005. So he has not played with some of those guys, but
now it's just all a big sham, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, I know. Now I'm like, well, he's played with Jeff Weaver. I mean, who cares?
Played with Eric Gagne.
Yeah, he's played with Adrian Beltre. He's played with Sean Green. He's played with Major League manager Alex Cora.
Played with Kevin Brown. Like, he's played with guys who have already fallen off the Hall of Fame ballot.
Yeah, but he's also played with Hideo Nomo. You know, just like the breadth of different, cool, interesting players he's played with. Like, he's definitely one of those guys that you'd love to sit down with and just pick his brain about the different people he's played with over his career, I think.
Yeah, I mean, now you've got me at the point where I'm looking through Alan Ashby, Wilson Alvarez. I don't know if they actually overlap because I think Alvarez is only around for a little bit, but that's a project event itself, and I think you should write that piece on. That'd be a fun reported piece too, right? Asking all these old guys, like,
absolutely.
What do you think of Edwin Jackson? Or asking Edwin Jackson to name his favorite teammates. It might take a little while. I feel like if he's really as nice as advertised, he might actually list every single guy he's ever played with, which I don't think anyone has enough. Space on their audio recorder to have all that. Plus, the transcription would be horrible. But the point is, we are Edwin Jackson fans here, and I don't know if we're Brandon Phillips fans necessarily, but he signed yesterday with the Red Sox. He will play third base in the minors. That's kind of cool, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's nice to see Phillips get another shot. The Red Sox are a team that has certainly had some issues at second base this season between Pedroia's injuries and Eduardo Nunez turning into a pumpkin. I think that it's, you know, one of those depth moves where you may not ever see him make the major leagues, but he'll provide a little AAA depth. And, you know, if things all break right, you'll see him in September or something like that. I'll probably head out to Pawtucket so that I can see him take the field and look much better than the rest of his teammates. So, yeah, I think it's kind of interesting. You know, Phillips has kind of a mixed bag reputation in baseball. So, you know, some people really don't care for some of the things that he's done. Other, you know, he's also got a reputation as being a good community guy. So, you know, like most of us, he's had his ups and downs, but I definitely think that this is an interesting move. And, even if he'll probably not make a huge impact for the big league club.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny because I had not mentioned Brandon Phillips' name since, you know, the Angels trade, since the end of last offseason, excuse me, since the end of last season, I guess. And then 2 nights ago, I was talking with Matt Snyder, who also works at CBS, about Javier Baez. And I mentioned I think he might be the flashiest defender I've seen in terms of quality and in, you know, stylistic purposes outside of maybe Brandon Phillips my entire life. And the next day, Brandon Phillips resurfaces. So I think the other guys I mentioned at that point were Yunel, but, you know, he wasn't on same level as these guys. He was just kind of flashy without being necessarily, you know, an all-world defender. And I want to say I mentioned someone else, but, you know, I'm having trouble thinking who it is. But the point is, you know, we talked about Baez earlier just in passing, and, you know, when you're getting mentioned next to Brandon Phillips in terms of your overall defensive quality but also your flashiness, that is a pretty good sign that you were slick with the lever, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that he is still an effective defender at this stage in his career, which is really saying something. That's a lot of time for you to be a plus defender at your position, no matter where it is. I guess we should talk about another former teammate of Edwin Jackson's, Jason Wirth, who has retired. He's what organization was he in the minor leagues with before he called it quits just now?
Mariners, right?
Yeah, the Mariners. Okay, that makes sense because that seemed like it was going to be a pretty solid fit for him, but the Mariners outfield has turned out to be much better than expected. I don't think he was going to get a shot this year and wasn't exactly having his best possible season in the minor leagues. So Jason Wirth ends his career. What do you think?
It was obviously a good career, and I think that contract with the Nationals worked out a lot better than people anticipated. Although, you know, he had some, let's call them, you know, down moments in Washington, D.C.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, it's kind of disappointing to see him go away without getting one more crack, just because I thought maybe he had a little bit left to offer. I know he wasn't great last season, but I don't know. I guess I just always, I'm a big softy with these guys, and I like to see him get that one last, you know, shining moment, so to speak, before riding off into the sunset. And I feel like Wirth went out on the opposite of a shining moment for his play in the postseason. Yeah, I don't know. I wish I had something poetic to say here, but I really don't. Like, he was a good player, a very good player, even for a while.
Yeah, he was really, really high-end base runner, which never got a lot of credit, which he never got a ton of credit for, I think, and that was kind of interesting. He had a couple of really, really brilliant seasons, 2009 with the Phillies, 2014 with the Nationals. I do think the Nationals got their money's worth out of that contract. I agree with you there. You know, four pretty solid seasons before tailing off at the end, and even his 2016 was fine. But he was a late start guy, which is hard to imagine because he's been around forever, but he didn't really get a lot of major league playing time until 2002 with the Blue Jays, which is, you know, for a guy like him, that was actually kind of a late start. So it would have been interesting to see him earlier in his career getting some more major league playing time. But four MVP, he got MVP votes in four different seasons. He was a one-time All-Star and, of course, never made it to get a World Series ring, but still
did
very,
it.
Very.
Got a ring in 2008.
Oh, sure, with the Phillies that year, of course.
Yeah, but and that's the other interesting thing too, because 2009 was the first time he got more than 500 plate appearances in a season. That was his age 30 year. So those Phillies, man, it feels like every single guy who came up with that iteration of the Phillies was a late bloomer or a guy who, you know, was held down for whatever reasons. You know, Ryan Howard was certainly that way. Were, I feel like Victorino was a little older than we thought he would be. And then I think Utley was also, I think he debuted, well, it looks like he debuted at 24. I would have said 25 or 26. It just feels every single guy there was kind of a, you know, in their mid to late 20s before they really got a crack. So interesting, interesting that's the case with Wirth as well.
And one of the interesting things for me is that he really did hit pretty well in the minor leagues with Toronto. Before he got a shot, you know, in 2001 when he was 22, he had an 853 OPS between two leagues with Toronto in regular playing time. That was in 2001. In 2002 in the minor leagues, in the International League, he had a 798 OPS and didn't really get a lot of run with Toronto. In 2003 in the International League, he didn't do quite as well, but he absolutely brutalized the PCL in 2004 for a short cup of coffee before the Dodgers brought him up. And then when he was with the Dodgers, he hit well, but didn't get a whole lot of run the next season. So, you know, it was just a very interesting sort of career for him. I think with regular playing time early on with Toronto, I think things could have turned out kind of differently.
I agree. And, you know, if Worth had made it to the majors with the Mariners, he probably would have enjoyed hitting off the Angels' recent waiver claim of Hansel Robles. Brian, you have a lot of experience with Mr. Robles, given that he had spent all of his big league career with the Mets. During that time, he made nearly 200 appearances, had a 4.07 ERA, that's a 98 ERA plus, 2.46 strikeouts per walks, but also gave up basically a homer and a half for nine innings. So what do you think here? Do you think the Angels are getting potentially a gem, or do you think that Hansel Robles is a witch who was put on this plan of existence to just pester the heck out of Mets fans?
I mean, he's really not. He's not as bad as I think a lot of Mets fans made him out to be. It's very easy to go against a reliever when they give up home runs at the rate in which Robles did. And let me tell you, one of the things that made him so maddening was his habit of he would throw a pitch and somebody would just bomb it. They would hit a no doubt powerful home run. And Robles has this habit of pointing to the ball like, hey, that's where it is. Somebody's got to catch it. And the ball goes into the second deck. Like, it's just an absolutely frustrating thing for Mets fans because he thinks that, this ball that somebody just hit 500 feet is going to somehow stay in the park. And so, of course, his first appearance for the Angels, he did the exact same thing where he gave up a massive home run and just he throws his hand up in the sky like pointing at it so his outfielders can go catch it. But his outfielders aren't 17 feet tall and don't live in the neighboring county, so they didn't catch it. But it's just it's maddening his home run abilities. I don't think he's that bad. I don't think he is a bad pitcher. It's just that you're going to have to expect that he's not a good pitcher. And, you know, from his strikeout rate in the past, people kind of have expected him to be a very good starting relief pitcher. In 2016, he had a very nice season. I think he's one of those guys that the Angels could rehab a little bit and have him be an effective part of an effective bullpen. But he's probably not anybody super special.
Yeah, and I want to mention, because you're talking about strikeouts and all, we talked about earlier the three true outcomes profile for a hitter. With Robles, you're looking at a guy who he's going to put a fair amount of hitters on by the free pass. And the thing is, when you're a guy who walks, let's just say 4 per 9, sometimes more than 4 per 9, because, you know, since his rookie season, he's been a guy who's walked closer to, you know, 4.5 per 9. When you do that, you really have to limit the quality of contact you allow, which means not giving up as many home runs as he gives up. So, yes, the strikeouts are nice, but the key for him is learning how to limit that quality of contact. And I don't know if it's realistic to think that he will improve his ability to do so, because he's already in his age 27 season. And also, he's a short right-hander. And you know I just do not like short right-hand relievers for the most part, especially guys who, I mean, I think I'm fair in saying he's a guy who probably has to pitch up in the zone a little bit with that fastball, right?
Yeah, and there's been some talk advocated by different people. I think Jarrett Seidler has advocated for this on the BP Mets podcast that originally he was a starting pitcher, and there's been some argument that maybe they should try to move him back into that role because he does have some secondary offerings. I think currently the Angels have 7 starting pitchers on the disabled list. So, I mean, at this point, maybe they should just give that a shot.
I don't think I agree with that because I think that would go very poorly, but I admire the creativity and...
Well, more poorly than the whole, Deck McGuire is now in the starting rotation for this team?
So is John Lamb.
No, John Lamb is injured. He is...
Oh, got hurt. Beyond an ego sprain, you mean? Oh, yeah, actually, okay, it's an arm injury. Now I felt bad. I did not... See, I missed that. I missed the John Lamb injury.
Of course you missed it, because John Lamb should not be in the major leagues to begin with.
I mean, hey, I think if there's anyone who can cancel Robles on what it's like to give up home runs and walks as a starting pitcher, John Lamb is as good a candidate as any. So
yes,
but I'm sorry, John Lamb. I hope you're healthy and you make a couple more starts before the year's out for the Angels.
I just don't know if there is anybody left in this organization who's capable of pitching major league innings. I just don't know at this point.
And I see that Brian has decided to troll me with the next move we are going to discuss, and hopefully discuss briefly, because the player in question deserves a lot better than this. But the Blue Jays designated for assignment my old friend Gio Urshela. They at one point had given him some run at shortstop, as we mentioned earlier. Traditionally, he's a third baseman, a pretty good defensive third baseman too. Unfortunately, Mr. Urshela cannot hit, and that's been proven a few times now. And in about 500 big league plate appearances, he has a 56 OPS plus, 90 strikeouts, the 28 walks. Just not going to get it done, no matter how good of a defender you are. He's only in his age 26 season. My expectation is that he will find a home in the majors again someday, perhaps as a useful bench player, although, again, he can't hit, and realistically, you're talking about a guy. Did you just laugh?
Well, you said a useful bench player, even though he can't hit, which there are a few of those in baseball. It's not like that doesn't exist, but I've just always been down on Urshela because I saw a lot of Matt Dominguez in him.
Yeah,
and very good defender, but very good defender at third base is not enough, and you've got to have some other sort of secondary skill, and he always had a little bit of raw power, but he was never able to really dial into it at the major league level. I'm not happy to see a guy get DFA'd. I'm never happy to see a guy get DFA'd, whether or not it's somebody I've been kind of down on in the past. So I wish he finds luck somewhere. I mean, you know, if Darwin Barney can hang on as long as he did, there's probably a place for Urshela with some team somewhere. But
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, the guy I advocated for, part of the reasons I was down on Urshela is because I thought that the Indians should be giving more run to Yandy Diaz. And Diaz is hitting very well in AAA right now for the Indians, but the Indians don't need either of these guys. They didn't need either of these guys. That's why Urshela left the organization. He ran out of options. But, Diaz hasn't really done anything at the major league level yet to speak of in his extended run either. So, I mean, it could just be one of those things where everybody is kind of wrong. We should have been more all in on Jose Ramirez from years ago.
Exactly. I will say that I think the Jays experimenting with Urshela up the middle is a good sign for him, especially if they like what they saw. Because, you know, you mentioned Darwin Barney. Well, I guess his ability to play up the middle, even if it was on the other side of second base, is, you know, kind of the separator, I guess, between being a career minor leaguer, or for the most part a career minor leaguer, and being a guy who teams could conceivably carry on their 25-man roster. There are still some teams out there, though, who really seem to prioritize defense when they build their benches. And I'm thinking of the Arizona Diamondbacks in particular here, because, you know, Jeff Mathis, I know Descalso has had a surprisingly effective season at the plate, but he was the guy who was mostly known for his defense and his defensive versatility, Gerard Dyson is a glove first guy for me. And I think there's one other guy. Nick Ahmed is
only
Giovanni Urshela, but he's a shortstop. And that makes all the difference in the world.
It really does. That's a very good point. So if Giovanni Urshela can be a shortstop too, then he'll stand a better chance of sticking around. Just on the subject of the Indians, though, I mean, why would they bother promoting a good defensive third baseman like Yandy Diaz, even if they were going to move some guys around? You don't need a good defensive third baseman when you have the three best pitchers in baseball in your starting rotation. And by the three best pitchers in baseball, I, of course, mean Shane Bieber, Trevor Bauer, and Mike Clevenger.
That's hurtful. That's hurtful. That's mean, but yes, the point is the Indians can pitch, at least when it comes to, you know, the first five or six innings in the game, the last few they're working on, and I fully expect that we're going to be talking about them in relation in regards to multiple relievers before July 31st. Although, I guess I just keep going back to, I don't know why you would even wait at this point till, you know, late July. It seems like there's, based on what we've seen with the Royals trades, it seems like there's not going to be any markup, but, so why don't you go out there and get guys now? And I'm sure they're trying. I've heard they're trying, but, you know, I don't know. I just expect they're going to be talking about them getting a reliever in the next 2 or 3 weeks rather than all the way to July 31st.
I mean, yeah, if I'm the Indians, I'm very, very disappointed that we missed out on Kelvin Herrera because I just don't know that there's a lot of other great... Now, granted, the Royals may not have wanted to deal with the Indians, period, but still, I think that there's not enough great relief talent on the open market. And this is a team that... You know, they've been doing so well with their rotation for so long, it only seems fitting that they would go completely the other direction. But right now, they've only got three effective relievers in their bullpen, and you don't expect that two of them, being Neil Ramirez and Oliver Perez, that's going to last very long.
Yeah, I mean, wow. Imagine relying on Oliver Perez.
In the year of our Lord 2018, no.
Exactly. But the good thing for the Indians, while we're on this topic, is that once they get to October, they're going to be able to hide the soft underbelly a little bit better. You know, as long as Allen and Miller are healthy and effective, and as long as that rotation stays healthy and effective, the games that they're in, they're going to be able, I think, to make it work. But they really still need at least one more reliever. And you're right, Herrera would have been a perfect fit. And we'll see if they go out there and get one of these guys we've talked about who might be a little bit of a longer-term fit, whether it's Yates or one of the Marlins' arms or whomever. But, yeah, the Indians have their work out for them on that.
I mean, when Carrasco comes back, you know, recently as in the last couple of outings for each pitcher, like Kluber's been the worst of those five starting pitchers.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable. It's a world-class rotation. The only problem is that the Astros have one of those two, so you may not make it out of the American League, you know, playoffs.
Yeah, and I guess I would also throw this out there. Do you think they would consider using Bieber in a relief role once Carrasco comes back? If they reach, well, they're going to reach the postseason, but you know, once they get to the postseason, do you think they would shift Bieber to basically the role that the guys like Clevenger have occupied in the past? It's sort of a, you know, a rover type who can come in and get, you know, outs over two innings, an inning and a third, what have you. And maybe that's one way to internally fix this problem, or at least help it along a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because when they get in the playoffs, it's very easy to imagine a world where they just run Kluber, Carrasco, and Bauer as their top three, and then move both Bieber and Clevenger into kind of that super reliever role. On most series. And then when you get into a seven gamer, yeah, you might have to roll with Clevenger as your fourth starter, which at this point is just, it's mean. It's mean to do that to other teams. Why would you do that to them?
And I think our final move of the day is something else that could be conceived as mean, and that is the Marlins are bringing up Sandy Alcantara. They got him in the Marcell Ozuna trade, of course. And I have to say, I don't think I believe Sandy Alcantara is going to be a starting pitcher in about 3 years' time. Do you?
I think he's still got a shot at it.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I think his pitching in the minor leagues so far this year has been good enough that you would want to keep running him out there as a starter for as long as you possibly can. I understand the concerns about him. You know, maybe he doesn't have the body type. He's too slim to really hold up as a starter for a long period of time. So, yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from with that, but he's got enough stuff that I think you just try to run him out there until he breaks. And yeah, it's possible that he's going to end up in the bullpen, but I like the stuff a lot. And I think that up to this point, he's shown the ability to pitch as a starting pitcher at some level. You know, he had 125 innings as a starter just in AA last year, five more starts in winter ball. I think he can probably do it for now. And I would give him every opportunity to do that.
Yeah, my thing is that I think he makes Juan Cruz look hefty. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I agree, you can give him a shot. That's why I said 3 years, because you figure he comes up a little bit this year. They give him at least one more year, maybe two more years. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being too rigid in what I think a starting pitcher should or could look like, and maybe I'll be proven wrong here, because I mean, I remember a few years back that we were all talking about how Luis Severino's delivery would not play in the rotation, and
right. Here
he is. He's arguably the best starter in the American League, or at least one of the best starters in the American League. So you never know with these things. And, of course, Marcus Stroman, a guy we talked about earlier, nobody thought he would necessarily stick in the rotation because of his height. So you have to be kind of open-minded about these things. But, yeah, I have my reservations about his body, and until he proves that the frame can hold up to a big league workload, I'm going to be skeptical. That said, and I think we have addressed this before as well, standard for what you need innings-wise as a starting pitcher, or to be considered for a starting pitching role nowadays, are so much different than they were 10, 15 years ago. So right. Maybe he's one of these guys who, no, he's never going to throw 180-plus innings, but 150, 140, that might be good enough heading forward.
And I will ask you this. Is he now the best starting pitcher in the Marlins rotation?
Trevor Richards is a guy who's kind of, he's got a fun story, and I wish I could say that I think he's better, but I don't think he's better. And I know Chin has been, how do I put this, awful.
I don't know if you're being strong enough, but yes, that's accurate.
Oh, he's been very bad, and it's kind of sad, too, because, you know, he wasn't solid enough starting pitcher. And then who else do they have there? I think it's Hernandez, it's Straley. So I think Straley's probably the best of that bunch, but I guess I would say Alcantara is at worst probably the second best starter in that rotation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think he might be, you know, I would still probably give it to Straley, but I'm not 100% sure I would. And Hernandez has only thrown 35 innings in this season at all. He's a Rule 5 guy. He's a Rule 5 guy from Houston, which means, you know, like, oh, there's still the possibility he could be quite good because Houston was really overwhelmed. It's like the Yankees. When you pull a Rule 5 guy from the Yankees, it's like, well, he could work out. Chen has been a complete and utter disaster. Richards has been pitching well. I just think that Alcantara is still probably better. And that's a terrible, terrible sign. When you lose Caleb Smith and you lose your no doubt number one starter, and Alcantara, I think maybe should have been in the rotation to start the season for this team because he's that much better than a lot of the other guys they've run out there.
Yeah, and I would also throw the Yankees into that mix. I think you did say the Yankees. You know, you said the Astros. Yeah, you said the Yankees. Because if you think about it, the Yankees have Brandon Drury and Ronald Torres in the minors. Those two guys would be on basically any other 25-man roster, and I would wager they would actually be starting most days for at least half the league. Maybe I'm being a little too overzealous there with the half a league remark, but
I don't know about that. I'm certain that we're talking about Brandon Drury on an episode of this show in the next couple of weeks because I don't think there's any chance that it's wonderful to have that kind of depth that they've got and everything, but they don't need him.
Yeah, and I believe I had just heard that he was playing some first base now, so maybe they're preparing to move on from Neil Walker, who I think we both thought that was an excellent signing, and he just has not taken to that role for whatever reason, so that's disappointing. But the Yankees are good, the Astros are good, the Red Sox are good, the Indians need some work, and the National League is a bloody mess. That's been your podcast, folks. Thank you for listening.
That's how we like to end these things, with hard truths from RJ Anderson. For more hard truths, you can look out for another episode of the show next week. Hopefully we'll have a trade or two to talk through. Hopefully it'll be something involving the Indians getting a worthwhile relief pitcher. I'm not holding out a whole lot of hope for next week with the holiday and everything, if we're going to actually see a lot of movement. But soon, we're getting there. We're getting into July. We'll be seeing some deals getting made, I would think, sooner rather than later. So it'll be interesting to see if we've got some stuff to report on our next episode.
I agree with all that.
To find out more about the DFA podcast, you can always go to Baseball Prospectus and find all of our old episodes of the show. We should have up a transaction analysis for Kelvin Herrera either by the time you're listening to this or shortly afterwards. You can find all of RJ's remarkable writing at CBS Sports/MLB. RJ, do you have something worth plugging for today?
I do, actually. Yes. Earlier today, we released a feature on Grant Desme. If you are not familiar with Desme's story, he was a pretty well-regarded prospect with the A's about 8.5 years ago, and then he retired at the height of his powers to go become a priest. He left St. Michael's Abbey, which is out there in California, last August, and became head coach at a small Florida Catholic college, and now he's actually back playing with the Lancaster Barnstormers of the Atlantic League, and at last check, he was doing well. So kind of a all-encompassing piece where the question is asked, why did Desme walk away? Why did Desme come back? What does he hope to get out of this? And it's at least possible, because about 20 players have been signed from the Atlantic League over the last 2 months, that we're going to be talking about a team signing Desme in the next few weeks. Although, you know, he's a 32-year-old really doesn't have much professional experience because of injuries and that he walked away. So not to a big league deal or anything, but maybe as an interesting or more interesting than normal piece of organizational depth. But yeah, he's a fascinating guy. And, you know, frankly, it was a scary piece for me. I mean, Craig Goldstein had passed along that he was playing again and told me I should write. And I was like, I don't think I'm good enough to do that. And, you know, I remember reading Jeff Passan's wonderful piece on Desmond's retirement and just being struck by it. And almost a decade later, to get to tell a little bit more of Desmond's story is humbling. And, you know, it's pretty cool. And I just hope that I did him and his story justice, because it's probably the, I don't know, it's one of the most fascinating stories in baseball, I think, over the last decade. So, yeah.
Well, I think most of our listeners know you and your work well enough to know that that piece will have certainly done Desme justice, and that you should have a little more confidence in your abilities, because we all very much enjoy your work. But until you get a chance to read that, we will be signing off. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope to see you soon on the next episode of the DFA Podcast.